Saturday, May 7th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Been another week of Apple and Mac news going by. I hope you had a great week. Mine was a little bit hectic, I have to say. But we're sitting down. We have a lot of things to go over. Been building up the show notes here. We're going to talk a little bit about the iPhone 7. Latest rumors are related to the home button and the fact that maybe there won't be one. Actually, that's a rumor that seems to keep resurfacing, isn't it? Apple had some trouble with the iPhone name in China. They're also struggling a little bit getting permission to sell iPhones in India. We're going to get into that. There is rumors that they may be looking to overhaul Apple Music a little bit, and also a little controversy over your Apple Music library. We're going to get into that a little bit on an LAPD iPhone hack and some misinformation that was sort of floating around, or not really misinformation, but, you know, as is typical, sensationalized information. We're going to dig in and try and balance things out for you. And then we have a little bit on Apple's rumored car project, looking like Apple is expanding a little bit. And we'll get into that. And then I have great feedback from you. A lot of conversation about wireless charging. That feature that may make its way into a future iPhone, and I shared my opinions on it. You also got back to me and shared your opinions, so we'll get into some of those and talk about that for a little bit. We're going to follow up a little bit on refurbished Mac gear. Got some great recommendations from you there to share. And Apple Watch trick that Gary learned, so he shared that with us. I'm going to talk a little bit about live recording on the Apple TV, get into Time Machine, and I have my thing of the moment. Actually, something fun that you may be able to play either over the weekend or maybe if you're getting a family gathering going on soon, I have a fun one for you this week. So stay tuned for that. But before we get into all of it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. And this week it is FreshBooks. Hey, look, if you run your own business, if you do anything where you have to track your time, you have to manage billings, you have to send out invoices, FreshBooks is a tool you want to take a look at, because they've created a easy, super intuitive way for creating, sending invoices, managing your business, managing your time, all kinds of really easy to use tools they provide to get all of that stuff done. As a matter of fact, FreshBooks is so easy, it literally takes 30 seconds to create and send an invoice. And you can get in there, you can customize it, you can throw in your own logo, your own color scheme. And, you know, I run my own business, and billing is one of those things that I just really don't enjoy. You don't want to have a complicated process. You want something that's easy and something that really helps you manage that, because it's not just generating the invoice and sending it out. You also have to follow up on it. You have to make sure you're getting paid. You have to know, you know, have I been paid yet? You need to share information with your accountant. And FreshBooks makes that easy as well. You can set up an account for your accountant so that they can just log in and they can watch your billings. They can track your time. They can help you with your business. You can set that up, and they have permissions controls, so it's read-only, and they make that really easy. If you need to follow up on invoices, they can automatically send out emails to remind your clients that they have a payment due, so you're not having to track on that. Another big one is maybe you don't want to wait around for a check, or maybe your clients, and I get this a lot from my clients as well, they ask, hey, can you take a credit card? If you have FreshBooks, super easy, built right in. They can pay you direct online, and then you'll know immediately when you get paid. And on top of that, you can pull great looking reports to track over time how your business is doing. And best of all, FreshBooks is offering a month of unrestricted use to all MacCast listeners, totally free right now. You don't even need a credit card to check out the trial. So if you've ever considered FreshBooks, now is a great time to take a look. And you can claim your free month by going to freshbooks.com/MacCast, and then just enter MacCast in the How Did You Hear About Us section, and you can start up on your free trial. And a big thank you to FreshBooks for their support of the MacCast. So could the next iPhone actually finally ditch the home button? I certainly hope not. This is something that I haven't wanted to see happen, but it's something that we've heard in rumors, although we have not heard this year that it's something Apple is considering for the iPhone 7. But an interesting report came out this week that LG has actually developed a fingerprint sensor called InnoTech that can be placed under the cover glass of a device. And they claim that it's super accurate. It has a failure rate, according to them, of just 0.002%. I don't think I saw any information on how fast it scans, but you may or may not know, Apple does use LG for some of the displays on their devices. So they have partnered with LG on display technology in the past. As far as fingerprint sensor technology, Apple really developed its own in Touch ID. They acquired Authentech back in 2012, if you remember, and that was the company that helped develop the current Touch ID technology that's in the iPhone. So the question would be, you know, would Apple even really want to go with another manufacturer's technology, or would they develop their own thing? I think we've seen some patents that Apple has filed in the past for similar technologies where you don't actually have a physical button for doing fingerprint scanning, where it's somehow integrated into the display, but LG actually has something now that looks like it could be viable for a commercial product. It's not clear that Apple will incorporate it or not. Apple has some patents on other technologies. If you remember, I think last week we talked a little bit about a liquid metal home button where they could have the button integrated right into the surface of the device, and there wouldn't be an actual physical button, but more like a little ridge or a bump with liquid metal that you could touch or press in, and it would deform and then bounce right back to its original shape. I think I called it the sort of pop-o-matic bubble technology. So there's a couple different ways Apple could go, but I don't see them actually losing the home button quite yet. A lot of people think that by getting rid of the home button, we could have a larger screen on the same size device. You've got a little more real estate. If Apple had a virtual button, maybe it could do a couple different functions. And I still am not very excited about it. I like my home button. I don't know what your opinion is, but I like actually having a physical thing. It's actually kind of soothing sometimes to just, you know, it's almost like a worry stone for me when I have my phone in my hand or my pocket. I'll just kind of rub my thumb on the fingerprint sensor and it feels good, right? I like the feel of it. I like the tactile nature of it. So I'd be kind of sad if that went away. And I've never been very happy with like Android devices that have those virtual buttons. It never felt quite right, especially for the home button, not to have something that you would press. But I don't think it's going to happen in the iPhone 7, but it was interesting to see that there is some technology out there that would potentially make this rumor we've been hearing about for years possible. There were also some supposed photos this week of the iPhone 7 Lightning port assembly. These surfaced on the Chinese site Weibo. And what's interesting is the assembly looks very similar to the assembly for the iPhone 6S, which means that it actually has a headphone jack on it, a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. And all of the rumors we've been hearing have been strongly pointing to the fact that Apple may ditch the headphone jack in the iPhone 7. But now here we have this part supposedly for an iPhone 7, and there is the headphone jack. So all of you who've been worried about the headphone jack, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show, the headphone jack going away, hey, you may not have to worry anymore, at least if this rumor turns out to be true. Now, Mac Takahara is now reporting that the smart connector, this is something else we talked about last week on the iPhone 7, that idea has been shelved. And I asked on the last show, you know, what would that connector be used for? You know, it seemed really odd to have on an iPhone 7. On an iPad, it's used for the keyboard connection. And you could argue, well, maybe Apple's going to come out with an iPhone, smart keyboard cover, something like that. But it's really too small. And Apple's always kind of maintained that, you know, on the iPhone, a virtual keyboard is really all you need. And it sounds like maybe they were kind of playing around with this idea. They've decided not to go forward with it. Some of the theories that were thrown out was, to me, when I asked you about this, is a few of you said, well, what if it was for charging, just a charging connector where you could have some sort of case or dock that would charge. The only issue I had with that is that the smart connector was actually located kind of in the middle on the back in some of the renderings that we saw leaked, and it was kind of right under the Apple logo. So the positioning of it didn't really make sense to jive with that. Some people had theorized that maybe it was for battery cases, so they could be a little bit slimmer and they could just connect right into the connections on the back of the phone. Yeah, maybe. And, you know, what struck me as odd if it was going to be a charging port or used for charging was that we still had the rumors of potentially wireless charging in the iPhone 7, and it would still have a lightning port. So suddenly you have three different charging connections on the device that to me just seemed way too redundant. So I was kind of happy to hear that the smart connector has been shelved, at least for now. I think they need to figure out what are we going to do with the smart connector on an iPhone. And until they actually have that answer, they're probably not going to roll forward with it. As far as how it's looking for the success of the iPhone, we got some news on that this week as well. UBS Research said that interest in upgrading to the iPhone 7 is high. They actually said it's larger than the interest was in the iPhone 6S series, which we know at this point did not do well in comparison to upgrades for the iPhone 6. So when Apple launched the iPhone 6, I think they had their best year of sales ever for an iPhone. And then we kind of saw a slowing or a roll off with the iPhone 6. And we know with these last quarter numbers that, you know, Apple is starting to see a decline in iPhone. And that's concerning to Wall Street. It's concerning, I think, also to Apple as well. They're not overly concerned about it. They think it's going to bounce back. And this information from UBS seems to agree with that. And I think it makes sense because I think more people are sticking now with a standard 2-year upgrade cycle for phones. We've talked about this a little bit. The features and the enhancements to the iPhone are really starting to become incremental. They're not revolutionary. They're not evolutionary. So a lot of people aren't feeling like they need to upgrade their phone every year. And we're seeing that. So all these people, since there was a huge push for iPhone 6, a large volume of people buying in on iPhone 6, I think the non-S year cycle years are now going to be the big years for iPhone when Apple is going to post the bigger numbers. And then on the off years, the S years, those are really going to be just people like us who are really into technology and just want to have the latest and greatest phone, but not really the masses. I see more people going 2-3 years with their iPhone upgrade cycle. So still the iPhone 7 is not probably going to match the iPhone 6, according to the report, but it should be back up there, and that should be good for Apple. Their analysts think it could bring the iPhone actually back into growth, and they are predicting between 5 to 10% growth in 2017 from sales of the iPhone 7. So if that prediction turns out to be accurate, that could be good for Apple. They could have a better year with iPhone, and that's probably going to help out with the stock a little bit. Now, finally, the iPhone isn't even in production yet. At least I don't think it is. And there are already rumors that Apple may be preparing for the next generation of the iPhone. I think we talked a little bit last week. There's some debate on whether it will be called the iPhone 7 or if Apple's going to go straight to iPhone 8. A lot of analysts, I think, including Ming-Chi Kuo, think that Apple's going to go to the 8 because they're going to do a radical design change for the next version, maybe even moving back to the dual glass design with glass on the front and glass on the back. But as far as the processor goes, it's being said that TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, I think it's corporation or company on the C, I always get that mixed up, they're said to be already taping out the design for the new A11 chip, which could start production about a year from now. And taping out basically means they're completing the design, the chip design, so that they can get ready to go into manufacturing and start producing the chips. The big news on the A11 chip is the design is supposedly based on a 10 nanometer FinFET process that TSMC is working on. For comparison, the current Apple processor, the A9s, those are 14 and 16 nanometer, depending upon which company is making them. I think Samsung has the 14 nanometer technology, and TSMC is currently doing the 16 nanometer technology. But if they can get down to a 10 nanometer size, it just means better performance, better energy efficiency, and smaller chips, which means thinner devices, more room for battery, all that fun stuff that goes along with that. So sounding like they've got chip designs a few years out. We still have the A10 to get into before we get into the A11, but you know, they're always working forward on this stuff, and we're hearing about it in the news this week. Apple's been fighting a trademark name battle in China over the iPhone. I had forgotten that this was going on. It's been going on for a while, and I know it's been going back and forth, but Apple suffered a pretty big blow this week because it lost its trademark dispute case with a Beijing-based leather products maker who also has cases that are labeled or called iPhone. The case was in appeal from an earlier ruling, which Apple also lost in a lower Chinese court, and Apple filed for the iPhone trademark in China. The whole story is a little bit weird because Apple filed for a trademark on iPhone in China in 2002. Now, if you're remembering your history, that's 5 years before Apple even brought the iPhone out in the US. The iPhone came out in 2007. But the problem is that in China, Apple was not granted a trademark on iPhone until 2013. And what happened in the meantime was a Chinese company requested the trademark for iPhone in 2007, again, the same year that Apple released the iPhone in the United States, and the leather company was actually granted the trademark in 2010. So 3 years before Apple was issued the trademark for iPhone in China. So just to clear that up, Apple files in 2002 for a trademark. In 2007, the leather company files for the trademark. The leather company gets the trademark in 3 years. Apple has to wait a full 11 years before they're given the trademark. Yeah, it's a little bit ridiculous. Now, what the court is claiming is that Apple couldn't prove in court that iPhone was well known prior to the leather company being issued the trademark in 2010. So really the dispute comes down to is, did people in China really know the brand iPhone? Now, I think you could probably argue that people of China did know that, but they knew the leather product in their country probably well before they knew the actual iPhone, because Apple did not start selling the iPhone in China until late 2009. And even then, it was only on China Unicom. So it wasn't, broadly available from all of the carriers in China, although China Unicom is the biggest one. So, you know, you could argue. But again, the trademark was granted just a few months later, I think, in 2010. So Apple lost that dispute. And a lot was being made about this in the news this week. But really, what does it mean for Apple? You know, Apple's going to continue to be able to sell the iPhone in China. It's not going to be issued for that. They're going to be able to continue to use the iPhone name in China. They're just going to have to share the trademark, or really not have that. I guess this one company has the trademark. Apple doesn't have the trademark, but they can continue to use the name because I guess they're different enough products that there shouldn't be any consumer confusion. So it kind of weakens the brand a little bit, but I don't think anybody's going to confuse iPhone the case for iPhone the smartphone device in China. The bigger deal here is that it was just another example of some of the current challenges Apple is facing in the region and the troubles they're having in doing business in China. If you remember last week, we talked about iTunes movies and books being shut down in China. Apple's been struggling on some other fronts, and all of this has kind of weighed in on the stock. As a matter of fact, Carl Icahn, who was a big investor in Apple, sold his stock. And one of the comments that he, all of his stock in Apple, and one of the comments he made when he sold it was he was concerned over some of the things that were happening in China. Now, news came out late this week that Tim Cook is traveling to China. He's going to be meeting with government officials to talk over some things, and I'm sure all of this stuff is going to come up. Hopefully, Apple will be able to work some of these things out. I think ultimately they're going to be fine in China, but it's a little rough going right now. And this whole iPhone naming thing is just another example of some of the challenges of doing business there. Apple is also having some challenges with the iPhone in India. If you remember, they had been trying to get permission to sell refurbished iPhones in the country. The idea being here that it's a price-sensitive market. Apple wants to get devices into market that can reach consumers that maybe don't have as much to spend on, say, an iPhone 6S or 6S Plus or even an iPhone SE. And selling refurbished iPhones would be a way to get at those lower price point sensitive consumers. Well, Bloomberg cited an unnamed official who said that the Indian government has now turned down Apple's request to sell refurbished iPhones in the country. One of the things that had been going on was Apple's competitors had filed objections with the government, implying that what Apple was trying to do was just dump old technology on India, and it would create a potential e-waste problem. And not only that, it would sort of fly in the face of or against the country's Make in India program, which is a program to promote companies coming in and actually manufacturing in India. Now, for its part, Apple would be selling only certified refurbished devices with brand new serial numbers in the country. And as you know, if you've ever bought a refurbished Apple product, they carry the same standard Apple Care warranty as new devices. So they're still warrantied for a full year. You know, these aren't shoddy, just, you know, it's not the kind of thing where Apple is just dumping devices. These would be certified Apple devices being sold in the country. But India has said, no, you can't do that. And really, Apple is looking to India as a big new market to help, once again, with some of the slowing iPhone sales. Growth in India has been huge. And right now, Apple's currently only has about 2-3% of the smartphone market in India. So they're really looking to grow there, and they really need lower priced options. And they saw this, you know, the ability to sell refurbished devices as a way to go about that. I don't know what they're going to do now. I just throwing out theories. I think one possible solution for Apple is they could set up a facility in China, a factory to actually refurbish the phones there in the country, and maybe go to the government and say, look, hey, if we do the work here, if we hire Indian workers, can we make some sort of agreement or some sort of arrangement? So that could be one way they could go. Or they could build an iPhone assembly facility in China and maybe find a way to make some components there and get in on the whole Make in India program, and maybe bring down some of their costs for, say, importing devices and things like that. So maybe there's some other ways Apple can work around to kind of get price points down a little bit more in India, but certainly selling refurbished phones that they ship in, that's not going to be possible, at least because of this ruling. And Apple has some precedent for doing the, you know, setting up a factory in another country. If you remember, Foxconn set up a factory in Brazil to make iPhones under similar pressures from government restrictions on sales, high tariffs, and those sorts of things. The only thing about looking at that program, I went back to see how it was doing. It hasn't really been a success, or not as big a success as the Brazilian government had hoped. It didn't generate nearly the number of jobs or the amount of revenue that the Brazilian government was hoping for. So that could work a little bit in not in Apple's favor if Apple goes to India to kind of set up a similar style program, and India points out, hey, didn't you try this over in China with your partner Fox, or in Brazil rather, with your partner Foxconn, and it didn't really work out. But we'll have to see what Apple's next move in India is. But certainly, if you listen to the last quarterly conference call, it's a big area of focus for Apple for growth of the iPhone. So I don't think this is going, you know, they lost the battle here, but I think they're going to continue to fight the war in India to try and get more market share and sell more devices. A report from Bloomberg says that Apple is looking to give its Apple Music service a little bit of a new paint job. They're going to put together a new music interface for Apple Music and show it off at WWDC, at least according to Bloomberg. The design, they say, is to better integrate Apple's new streaming services with the existing iTunes download business, plus expand Beats One. So the thought process here is that Apple's music service, Apple Music, was supposed to help drive download sales, and that really isn't working out. So they're hoping by changing some things around, redesigning some things a little bit, the two are going to work more in tandem, better together, and maybe generate more download sales along with generating more revenue from the streaming service, which is growing. And we saw some good numbers in the last quarterly results related to services and specifically Apple Music. Now, the redesign is reportedly being driven by the head of Apple Music content, Robert Kondrick, and also Trent Reznor. Yes, Nine Inch Nails Trent Reznor. He's said to be kind of the main guy on the design side of things, with input and guidance from Johnny Ive, Eddie Q, and Jimmy Iovine. So it's kind of a group effort to kind of get this thing working just the way they want it. And it could possibly also bring some of the new Beats 1 radio stations that we had heard rumored about. Apple actually has trademarks for Beats 2 through Beats 5, so there could be additional stations. And I hope that really does happen. I enjoy Beats 1, but it would be nice if it was divided up a little bit more, maybe by genre or interests or things like that, and Apple could kind of split things apart so that, you know, people who are into one style or one kind of music or one type of entertainment content can get that from the various stations. And I think that makes a lot of sense. So I'm hoping that comes about in this round. But really, the stronger rumor is that Apple's looking to do just a visual redesign. Now, the design supposedly focuses on a few new functions and a lot of reorganization, as well as simplification of some of the existing features. They say it's going to have a simpler design that uses black and white backgrounds and text. So no more matching album cover colors of text. You know how when you click on an album cover, the text as it expands out matches the color? Nope, it's not going to do that anymore. There's going to be more focus on the artwork. As a matter of fact, one of the reports said it's going to be quote unquote huge and take up a larger part of the user interface. And that would be the color. The album art would be the focus to bring color and interest to the page designs and sort of offset the more black and white elements. It's said to be bold yet simpler in terms of the design. Some of the other features that have been mentioned: stronger use of 3D touch for previews and sharing. So if you have a phone that supports 3D touch, there's reportedly going to be more integration there, more focus on the user interface of the For You section. So it's sounding like For You is going to become the big area of focus when you're an Apple Music subscriber. And to be honest, that's, for me, where I'm spending most of my time. I occasionally get into the new section and maybe drill down to some of the playlists and stuff like that, but I'm often now going to the For You recommendations. And I think that's working out for me because I've done a lot of favoriting and kind of telling Apple Music, hey, this is the kind of stuff I like. And the more I've been using it, the better it seems to be getting, at least for me. And so along those lines, one of the rumors is that the new tab is actually going to be replaced with a tab called Browse, and it's still going to contain top charts and genres, featured music launches, and the curated playlists, but supposedly will have better organization. And I think Browse makes more sense because not everything in there is quote unquote new, especially some of the older playlists and the curated playlists and stuff like that. And I do like going into those sections, but it never made sense to me that that was always under new. So it was always kind of confusing. They're also saying that the Connect tab is going to get demoted. Connect is not going away. A lot of places were sort of reporting that the service was being killed off because it's been a failure. That's not clear at this point. It certainly is being demoted and not being given as much of a focus. It's being moved into the For You section. But does that mean it's failed or on the way out? Maybe. I can tell you it's one feature that I've used the least. And I think it's mainly because artists supposedly have been struggling with the interface for the back end and actually getting their content in there. So I think in theory, the concept was good, that I could follow my favorite artists, I could connect with them, they could give me, you know, candid snapshots from the road, kind of the stuff that they would normally post on Instagram and Twitter. Those would go into Connect. You could have lyrics, exclusive songs, little demos that they would release. That really hasn't been happening. And supposedly it's because the interface is really not good. So hopefully Apple focuses a lot on the back end and the Connect integration so that artists will actually use it. And I think if they can get artists using it, give them some incentive to use it, then I think the fans will come along. But until the content's there, that's going to be really hard to do. I think Instagram is becoming the big place where a lot of this stuff is happening. So if Apple can do better integration there so that when an artist posts to Connect, it can also be posted out to Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all the other social media places, not just Apple Music. It's probably a classic case where Apple's trying to enforce too much control and kind of keep everybody sandboxed too much. And really, when it comes to social media, I think they've got to be a little bit more open about those sorts of things. So I just haven't found it that useful, but hopefully it'll get a little bit of love in this redesign as well. Another cool thing is they're saying they're going to finally bring in support for song lyrics, but supposedly Apple is still working with the labels on this, trying to get the rights and permissions that they need. So that rollout is going to be more gradual. But yeah, to be able to go in and be listening to a track and actually get at the lyrics information right inside the music interface, that would be a really good thing. You know, right now you've got to kind of, you have to kind of kludge it together. You can download the track and maybe pull in the lyrics and put it into the metadata, but that should be built in. That should have been built in a long time ago. So it was good to hear that that might be coming around this time. The piece also talks about some of the friction or culture clash that supposedly exists between Apple employees and Beats employees. You know, Apple bought Beats and they brought that company in, and they have different cultures, and they're clashing a little bit. As a matter of fact, even at the top levels, the report says that Jimmy Iovine is often out making deals with artists and labels. He has a really good, tight connection to the artists and labels, and that's a good thing for Apple. He's supposedly the guy that smoothed things over with Taylor Swift, for example, and has been securing Apple Music rights for exclusives like the new Drake album. Taylor Swift is now doing Apple commercials. So, you know, he did a good job there. But supposedly Apple staff is out, you know, trying to do deals with the labels, and Jimmy's talking to them on the other side. And that can sometimes cause a little bit of confusion and frustration. Some Beats employees have supposedly not been very happy about the approval process at Apple. They call it laborious, and that, you know, for new products, you know, Apple says it's in place so that they can ensure product quality. So I'm assuming this is more on the headphone side of things, but they don't like, you know, all the approvals they have to go through to get something done. But, you know, that's part of Apple's QA. So that clash is going on. But, you know, it's said that this was actually intentional. They wanted a little bit of conflict to kind of shake things up and get people thinking and pushing them and driving towards putting out the best quality product that they can do. It's one of the things that Apple kind of does. And, you know, a lot of times a little bit of tension can actually turn out to be good. And I kind of buy that. But it still resulted in some departures of some critical Beats One staff. So it's a little bit rough. As far as we know, this UI change is happening only on the Apple Music side. iTunes, while many people want it to get an overhaul, it probably does need an overhaul. We're hearing there's going to be some minor tweaks, mostly in the sidebar area, but it really hasn't been mentioned. And one thing that I think many people don't know about the iTunes Store and Apple Music and stuff like that is basically the UI is just a big giant web app. So a lot of the design changes and things can happen without even a major release of a new music application. It can kind of happen on the back end, and Apple can just push the stuff out. But supposedly we're going to get a little preview at WWDC, and I'm looking forward to see what they do with it. I, in particular, have been really enjoying Apple Music, and even the way it is now, I think it works pretty well. So anything they can do to make it better, to bring in more integration with iTunes and music, to bring in things like lyrics and get me better connected to the artists and the music and what's going on there, better recommendations, I think that's all really good. And so far, things seem to have been going well for Apple. Apple recently announced that Apple Music has 13 million paid subscribers. It's in the services section of Apple's business, which grew 40% last quarter, one of the big areas of growth for the company, even though it's a smaller portion of the overall revenues. And something else that's going to help that happened this week is Apple Music also just started offering a 50% discount on Apple Music subscriptions for students. So that means in the US for $4.99 a month, if you're a student, you can get Apple Music. The discount is also available to students in the UK, Germany, Denmark, Ireland, Australia, and New Zealand. You need to be enrolled in an eligible college or university. And what's cool is once you have the discount will be available for up to 4 years following your sign up. So once you've signed up, you can get the discount for 4 years, and those years don't even have to be consecutive. So if you take a year off of school and come back, you can continue to get that discount. So you get 4 years of the discount, and Apple is using a leading student verification technology provider called Unidays for the verification. So you just have to go to the website, go through the verification process. They'll verify that you are a current registered student with an eligible college or university, and you can get that discount. And I think that's really going to help, again, drive up Apple's paid subscriber numbers. And I think Apple knows if they can get people hooked on the service while they're young, they're more likely to continue with the service after graduation, after they move into the career world. And, you know, I think that's ultimately going to be a good thing. So refocus on Apple Music, or a bigger focus on Apple Music, I think was to be expected, especially given what we saw happening with Apple services in the last quarterly results call. Now, everything is not always rosy with Apple Music, and I am the first person to admit that the service does need some work. It's a little rough around the edges, especially when it comes to the music matching part. And that hit a little bit of a controversy this week because there was a story circulating about a guy who claimed that Apple Music deleted his entire local music library and files, and that an Apple rep, when he called to complain about it or mention it, said that, oh yeah, that's normal, that's a feature. Now, luckily he had a full backup and was able to recover everything, so yay backup, you know, you all have backups as well. But it did create a bit of a controversy. And I think, you know, the problem started, we're not exactly sure what happened, and it could be that there was some sort of bug or hiccup that caused the library to get deleted. What we do know is, one, it's not designed to work that way at all. Two, that Apple Music does have some little quirks when it comes to the area of song matching. Often the iCloud music library will get odd substitutions of tracks, and we're going to talk about why that is in a second. Very often live tracks or compilation tracks might be replaced for studio tracks or vice versa. And you know, those things, though, should only be happening in the iCloud music library, not the local one. And I think this is where a little bit of the confusion started and where the problem might have happened for this guy. As I said, we don't know exactly what happened, but there's a great piece from Serenity Caldwell over at iMore. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com that explains probably what happened. I'm kind of on her side. I think this makes sense. And, you know, the issue is that a lot of people don't understand when you sign up for Apple Music and you activate the iCloud Music Library, or if you're using iTunes Music Match, it's confusing. How Apple has it set up is confusing, and that confusion can lead to some of these problems. So the way it works when you enable this service is basically you turn it on your quote-unquote main Mac. So the Mac that has your primary iTunes library on it, the one that you would sync with your device, your iPhone or your iPod Touch, you turn on iCloud Music Library or iTunes Match, but I'm going to just focus on iCloud Music Library because we're really talking about Apple Music here. So when you turn that on, it scans through your entire iTunes library on your Mac. Any tracks that it matches that are available in the Apple Music Library, those will be activated on your account and made available in your iCloud Music Library. Anything that doesn't match, that is 128 kilobits per second or higher, is uploaded to your iCloud Music Library. So that could include, and this guy apparently was a musician, he had some tracks that he had recorded himself. Those tracks were actually captured when he turned on iCloud Music Library and pushed up into the cloud. Okay? And any of the local unmatched music that is not in AAC format will get converted to 256 kilobit per second AAC files, but only in the iCloud Music Library. So only on the cloud side. Nothing in your original library is touched. And that's the key here, is the local copies retain all their original formats, all of their original, you know, tracks and things like that. The one thing that can happen is sometimes some of the metadata might get tweaked. The images, the artwork images, or some of the metadata. And that really shouldn't happen. I mean, that is actually one of the problems with Apple Music and iCloud Music Library. But, you know, basically after the scanning, matching, and uploading process is done, what you have to understand is you end up with two separate libraries. You have that main Mac original library that should remain mostly untouched, and then you have the new iCloud Music Library, which is the thing that lives on Apple servers. And the music in iCloud Music Library may be slightly different than that local copy. But as long as you don't remove or delete any items from that local copy on your Mac, they will never be automatically deleted or replaced by Apple, no matter what you do. Now, the iCloud Music Library, as I said, may change some tags and artworks, and that's annoying and mildly destructive, but it's really far from actually deleting, you know, your entire library, which is what happened to this guy. Now, what happens with other devices is different. If you have a second Mac or you have an iOS device and you turn on iCloud Music Library, what it's going to do is it's going to go out and it's going to grab those tracks from the iCloud Music Library. And these are those matched ones. And as I mentioned earlier, they can sometimes be incorrect. And again, this is a bug and a problem with Apple's matching algorithms. And I apologize if I'm being a little bit repetitive here, but I want to be very clear about this. And as you can tell, even I am struggling with the terminology here, and I think the naming is also part of the problem. But basically, your other devices are always accessing the iCloud Music Library, the stuff that's up there. So it's those uploaded copies. Again, remember, some of them have been modified. So if you had an AIFF on your main Mac's library, the one in the cloud is going to be 256 kilobit AAC, and that's going to be the thing that your second Mac or your iOS device is getting. So that is tweaked. And you can download those things, but they're going to, again, be coming from the iCloud Music Library. They're not coming from your main library. Main library remains untouched. And so the problem arises if you ever try to remove the original files from your main Mac. If you try deleting one of those tracks, you get a very confusing dialogue. It says, "Are you sure you want to delete the song? This will delete the song from iCloud Music Library and your other devices. To keep this song in your library and on your other devices, you can remove this download instead." And it's that word download that gets confusing, because you're presented with three buttons and it says remove download, cancel, and delete song. And delete song is the default. If you delete the song, it's going to move the song from your main library to the trash, and then also delete the song and remove it from iCloud Music Library, which has the effect, because all of your other devices, your secondary devices, and your iOS devices are attached to iCloud Music Library, the song will be deleted from there as well. Okay? And this, remember, you're deleting a song from your original music library. And so you might think, okay, well, then maybe I just want to remove download. That's going to delete the one in iCloud Music Library, right? Because that's the thing that I would download from. No, that's not the case. By remove download, what it means is if you use iCloud Music Library and you have a track up there, you can actually download it to your Mac. If you choose remove download, it will also delete your local file. It's not going to delete the one in iCloud Music Library. That one it's going to leave in place, because if you remember the earlier part of the message, it says to keep the song in your library, and that really should say iCloud Music Library and on your other devices, right? That one's referring to the iCloud Music Library, but they don't say that in the dialogue. They just say library. So you might think that means your local library. And this is where the confusion comes into play. So really the correct answer, if you want to keep your music in your original library, you need to say cancel. And I think often what happens is someone will be going through, they'll accidentally hit delete, or they'll do something in their local music library to delete it. They'll see this dialogue, and then they click remove download, and that's where the trouble starts. That's where things get deleted. But it's not the service deleting it, it's you deleting it based on a really badly worded dialogue. Okay, so hopefully this makes sense. Really, Apple needs to at least add iCloud Music Library to that library word, and the word download, remove this download, should not say that. Remove this track, remove this song from your local library instead. That might be more accurate, but that's where the issue is. So, you know, another issue can be that sometimes people assume that they have all of their music uploaded to iCloud Music Library. Well, that means I can delete my local library, no problem, because I can always just re-download from iCloud Music Library. And they'll do that because they want to maybe save space and just stream and re-download the music. But obviously a bad idea because of the reasons we noted earlier, right? The tracks can get tweaked in iCloud Music Library because Apple does have some issues there. So you don't want to do that. You want to make sure that you keep all of your originals on that one main Mac and do not touch those. Do not delete them. Do not remove them. Keep them there and you will be much better off. And I would even say before you enable iCloud Music Library, make sure that you've made an archive of all your original local music, back it up, stick it on an external hard drive, put it somewhere and just, you know, file it away in case something does happen. Because again, we don't know what happened with this guy. It could be some weird bug that he just ran into and no one's been able to replicate yet, but it's highly unlikely. It's more likely that, you know, at some point he actually deleted some of this local music or accidentally deleted this local music and it started this kind of bad chain reaction. So a lot of people are quitting Apple Music over this. I've been using Apple Music very successfully for a long time, but again, I don't do anything with the main music library on my Mac. And this is all the stuff that I ripped from my CDs years and years ago. I leave that alone. I don't re-download it from Apple Music. I don't change it. I keep that as the pristine originals. And that's probably the best way to go. The other option is to add in the iTunes Match service because that works a little bit better. And if you re-download the music, yes, you'll get it in a different format, but that's yours to keep. The problem, if you're just using Apple Music and you've downloaded, you know, copies from your iCloud Music Library, you don't get to keep that stuff after you cancel your subscription. So that's another reason why you want to maintain and keep that original music library intact. So hopefully this helps explain things a little bit more, clear things up a little bit. Apple certainly has some work to do on their end. They're not completely innocent of this, but this really ultimately wasn't all their fault or all their problem. There was just a little bit of misunderstanding and a little bit of user error that happened as well. Well, it's starting to become a thing where we can't get through a week without some story about an iPhone and law enforcement and hacking, although this week it wasn't the FBI, it was the Los Angeles Police Department. Apparently they've been trying to get into an iPhone 5S that is part of evidence in a murder investigation. They want to get access to it, but it's locked with Touch ID, or was locked with Touch ID. Apparently there was a sequence of text messages on the device from shortly before the murder, and that's what the cops were after. And they found an expert this week to crack the device, and they were able to actually successfully get in and access the data. And the news reports that followed are the main thing that I want to talk to you about, because many of them suggested that Apple had a flaw in their technology, specifically in the Touch ID or secure enclave that was on the phone. Now, does Apple have a problem? Well, the short answer is no, but the reason why is because this iPhone 5S was taken into evidence in May of 2014. So given the date, it had to have been running iOS 7 or earlier because iOS 8 did not come out until September. And the thing is that it wasn't until iOS 8 came out that the device had full device encryption. So because it was running an older version of the operating system, there were known exploits and tools that actually could get into the data. And Apple knew about this, and this is why they put newer, more mature security measures in place in iOS 8. So the LAPD and the company that they hired, they could have used a tool like, for example, IPBox, which was this piece of hardware that you could hook up and you could make passcode cracking attempts and it would actually cut power or turn off the device before any kind of lockout happened and then reset itself and then it could go on and continue to crack and hack at the passcode. And as a matter of fact, the IPBox could get into an iPhone device within between 6 seconds and 17 hours, depending upon the complexity of the passcode. So this this kind of made big headlines and big news this week, but it really wasn't a big story. This kind of hack has been going on for a while with older devices. So again, remember when you're hearing these stories, I think the important takeaway to understand is that it depends on which operating system it has, which device it is, and all those sorts of things. But, you know, an iPhone 6 or 6S, series with Touch ID and running iOS 9 is pretty well encrypted, and most people are going to have a hard time cracking into that unless, I guess, they get at whatever the FBI's new technique is. But as we know, the FBI isn't telling anybody what that method is. And then finally in the news for this week, I guess when you have a Titan, you need a lot of room for that guy to run around. And by Titan, of course, I'm referring to Apple's rumored car project. Titan is supposedly the code name, at least according to Apple Insider. There's a rumor this week that Apple is looking at an 800,000 square foot facility in San Jose to be used for its ever-growing secret car project. The space is on a 43-acre plot of land across the way from 101 South Tech Campus, where actually Apple currently leases about 300,000 square feet of office space. The info apparently slipped during a Pacific Properties quarterly earnings call. They said, hey, Apple's looking at this piece of property over here that we have. And the Wall Street Journal recently reported that sources have told them that the Titan Car project has grown to about 600 employees, at least as of last year. So Apple needs some room to spread out. And 800,000 square feet would be a nice way to do that. We've also heard rumors that Apple has gotten to the stage where they want to be prototyping car parts and have discussed maybe even partnering with a company called Magna, who actually is a car maker for BMW Mini, and Apple may partner up with them on manufacturing. But they're getting to that stage where they're starting to put things together. They're starting to maybe start to do some assembly or at least some parts production. And while the space could be, you know, would be too small for full-scale production facility, many watchers think that it could be used as a facility dedicated to R&D, or at least potentially pilot manufacturing of parts and components. So looking at Apple potentially expanding, everything they're doing over in San Jose, though, is really secretive. They've got a bunch of shell companies set up. Really, Apple Insider is doing a lot of the legwork on these stories. So if you want to follow this project a little bit more closely, make sure that you're reading along and following Apple Insider. But interesting stuff happening. You know, I'm still kind of on the fence about how I feel about Apple making a car. I think it could be really cool. I'm worried that they're going to be late to market with a lot of the stuff that's happening with the Tesla Model 3 and the Chevy Bolt. So they may have to step things up a little bit, and maybe, you know, this expansion and quickly hiring more employees, maybe that is Apple showing a little bit more urgency on this project and trying to bring something to market maybe a little bit sooner. But it certainly seems like things are heating up relatively quickly, and we're starting to hear more leaks and more rumors come out. And usually when that happens, it means Apple's getting closer and closer to actually showing us something. And I guess I am a little bit excited about that. But I don't know. What do you think of Apple as a car company? Is this really the next big thing? Is this what's going to take Apple to the next level? It seems like it could be a little bit risky. But, you know, if Tesla can do it, I think Apple could do it potentially as well. But if you want to share your thoughts and opinions with me, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now, if you remember last week, we started talking a little more deeply about one specific rumored feature of the next iPhone, and that is wireless charging. And there's an interesting thing that happens in our community every once in a while. There'll be a feature or a topic or something that just generates a ton of feedback. And this one certainly did. I think it's probably because I'm having a really hard time, and I mentioned this, I'm having a really hard time understanding the draw or the appeal of wireless charging. And I'm trying very, very hard. And so I asked for some of your feedback and your thoughts on it. And many of you agreed with some of my sentiments, and you're having a hard time understanding it as well. But many others wrote in with their opinions, and I really appreciate that. And I want to share some of those. But probably the biggest overarching opinion was, well, it's about convenience, right? It's about not having to take a cable and plug it into your device. I can simply set it down on a table, put it by my bedstand, you know, my nightside table, put it on my nightstand, rather, if I can use the word, put it on my nightstand at night and just charge. I don't have to worry about it. I just set it down and I go to sleep and everything is wonderful. And I get that. I get that it's a hair more convenient than, you know, picking the cable up off your nightstand and plugging it into the bottom of your device. But I'm just having a hard time seeing that little amount of time is such a huge benefit or convenience for people. And, you know, I thought, well, let me give people the benefit of the doubt. Let me look into this a little more deeply, because I hadn't looked that deep. You know, I just saw wireless charging. It's kind of this gimmicky feature. So the more research that I've done and the more that I've learned, I've just determined I'm even more right. I think, I don't know, you could tell me I'm wrong. I'm happy to hear that I'm wrong. But, you know, most devices now apparently use something called the QI standard. And the way this works is there has to be a charging pad, and it typically looks like a puck. You know, people talk about these pads like they're flat things that would just sit on the nightstand. No, it's actually like a little puck. If you look at your Apple Watch charger, you know, that little puck. Now imagine something like that, about that thin, but maybe the size of a coaster. Okay. Most of them look like that. They're either round or they're square, but they're not totally flat. Maybe there's some flatter ones in the square shape. But point is like it's a pad. It's a thing. And the phone has to sit on that, but not just, you know, tossed on there haphazardly. It actually has to be aligned on the pad in the correct location. So depending upon where the charging receiver is within your device, it has to be over the center of that puck to get the most effective charging. And the location seems to vary by the phone and the design. And sometimes I think there's some magnets and things to help line things up. Again, like the, I think, Apple Watch, right? It lines up. And I've even misaligned my little tiny Apple Watch one a couple times and then woke up with no charge. So just another issue. So if you don't get it perfectly aligned right, it's not going to charge. And the point there is it's not as simple as just, you know, toss it onto the pad, it'll charge. That's so easy. No, it doesn't work that way. If you misalign it, you're not going to get the charge. The other thing that I've discovered is that the charge times are about twice as long as if you're plugging a cable into a wall charger. Now, if you plug your cable into your computer, wireless charging is going to be faster than that. But wireless charging itself, when it's plugged into an outlet, is not as fast as plugging in the cable. And if you're like me, a lot of times you're at the airport, you're trying to, you know, top up and get that quick charge. Sounds like wireless charging is not going to be as efficient. So just another ding on wireless charging. Now, one person did point out to me that there is a slight advantage for visually impaired users because they don't have to hunt around for the small little lightning port on the bottom of the device to plug in. That I get. That makes sense to me. Yeah, it'd be a little bit easier if you could just, you know, set it on a device. But again, if it has to line up exactly and it doesn't have magnets to help you do that, that may actually even be a bigger problem for visually impaired people. Now, I think some of the wireless charging pads do have an audible signal so that when you're aligned, you know, ding, okay, I got it in the right spot and it's charging. So that could help, you know, an audible alert. But it was also pointed out that, you know, if Apple loses the headphone jack on the bottom of the device and the only thing you have is a lightning cable, if you want to use wired headphones, which would use either the lightning cable or some sort of dongle to convert lightning to 3.5 millimeter, well, then you couldn't use your headphones and charge at the same time. So wireless charging would solve that problem. And that makes sense to me. Okay, I get that. You know, there's a possible solution to how do I charge and have something plugged into the lightning port at the same time. Well, wireless charging would solve that. But so would a 3.5 millimeter dongle with a pass-through lightning cable. And Apple has had those kind of dongles before. I admit it's not ideal. I don't like that solution. But it is an alternate solution that wouldn't rely on wireless charging, which, as we've already established, I think is, you know, kind of silly. I don't get it. And both Keith and Cesar mentioned that one potential advantage of wireless charging is avoiding wear and tear on cables, meaning that, you know, you don't have to deal with broken cables. And I think anybody who's had an iPhone and had a lightning cable or an iOS device and had a lightning cable has probably had a broken one at some point because you're using it in bed or using it in different orientations, and it puts some strain on the connection, and the connection eventually breaks. I've gone through a lot of lightning cables because of that, and you can reinforce them and things like that, but wireless charging would solve that problem. Yes, I agree with that, because you'd have the puck plugged in, and it wouldn't really be moving around. You have to take the device off, but that's also one of the major disadvantages that I think I talked about last week, is the inability to charge and use the device at the same time. Now, presumably, the lightning connector will still be there as well, so you could do one or the other. But as I pointed out, that just overly complicates things, because now you have to have components not only for the lightning cable, you know, for the lightning connector inside the phone, but you also have the wireless charging thing taking up room. And the two things are doing the same function. So why have functional redundancy when it's just going to take up more space in the device. So I'm just really not getting it. But something else I pointed out last week was that I'm in the minority. I'm in the wrong on this, because there was a survey done, and the survey showed that the number one feature that people want in the next iPhone is wireless charging. Everybody's very excited about wireless charging. They think it's going to be great and wonderful and so convenient. And Matt wrote in and he questioned the survey and said, well, are you sure that this is the number one feature? Because, you know, have these people tried wireless charging? Do they know what it's like? Do they know that this experience is flawed? And I think if you talk to people who have Android devices who have wireless charging, what you'll find is it's kind of split. I don't think everybody really likes it. I don't ever think everybody who has it thinks it's this great, wonderful feature. So he shares my theory that, you know, basically I think people think they want wireless charging. When they hear about it, they go, oh, that's a cool technology, wireless charging. And I've done this. It sounds amazing. It sounds like it would be this great thing. But once you have it, or once you start digging into it, the promise of the convenience is hollow, and it has too many other disadvantages. The slow charging is a big one for me. The slower charging rate. I'm always trying to find ways to get my devices to charge faster, not slower. So I just don't see this being a feature that I think Apple should throw in there. Plus, add to that that there are aftermarket solutions for this technology for the iPhone. The QI standard charging bases you can buy. And you can buy a little thing that slides in or sticks to the back of your phone that will give you the receiving technology. They run between $12 and $20, has a little flex cable. It's this thin little receiver. It has a flex cable that plugs into the lightning port, and then you stick that to your back of your phone or slip it between your case and your phone, and now you can drop it on any QI-compatible charging pad. Anker makes one called PowerPort QI. It sells for $16. And you can get this technology in your current phone. So if this is something you want to try out, you might try this. You know, spend $12 to get a little charging base for your phone. Spend $16 to get the puck, the charging pad, I guess is what you call it, and give it a shot. See what you think. But I think because there's aftermarket solutions, this is something that, and because of all the other disadvantages that I mentioned, I'm hoping this rumor turns out to not be true, that Apple doesn't put wireless charging in there, because it sounds like it's not quite ready for prime time and it sounds like it's gimmicky. But again, I'm really open to your opinions and your thoughts on this. I would really welcome some audio comments. If you think I'm a total quack and totally wrong on this, let me know. If you agree with me, that's fine too. But I'd really like to hear from people who completely disagree. Make your arguments. Sell me on. I'm willing to be won over to wireless charging. But as it stands right now, I'm just really not seeing it. But maybe that's because I'm naive. And please show me I'm naive. Send in your feedback. Last week, we also talked a little bit about the idea of not maybe buying or upgrading our hardware and technology so frequently to maybe save money and maybe not spend so much on our technology, or realize that we always don't need to be chasing the next new latest and greatest device. And we also talked about when you go to buy a new device, maybe also looking at refurb gear and refurbished Macs and saving a little bit of money there. And, you know, I recognize that this isn't for everyone in our community, but I also recognize that very often, and I know I've been guilty of this myself, there seems to be a lot of pressure, especially if you're a nerd or someone who's into technology. There's a lot of pressure from your peers to always be upgrading, to always have the latest and greatest thing. And I'm not so sure that's always the healthiest thing for our community, right? Maybe you don't always need the latest and greatest thing. So there's two things I want to follow up on based on some of your feedback from this last episode. The first was, I got a lot of really great suggestions for places to go get discounted refurbished Mac products. You know, the place that I always usually turn to is the clearance section on Apple.com, on Apple's store. But a few of you wrote in, and I wanted to share some of these recommendations with you. Now, I will tell you, these are coming from our community. I don't, or haven't, other than one of these, used any of these services, so I can't vouch for them one way or the other. Maybe you, if you've used one of these services, can back up some of our other listeners. But Gary wrote in to recommend a website called Blink, B-L-I-N-Q, blink.com. So you can check that one out. He says they have some great stuff there that he's bought, and it's worked out well. Gary, a different Gary, wrote in to give a shout out for Power Max. Power, P-O-W-E-R-M-A-X, powermax.com. And I can tell you, this is a Portland or an Oregon company, and I've actually been out to, they have a retail store in Oregon, and I've been there. That's where I bought my original blue and white G3. And that was actually a refurbished model from PowerMax. And so I can vouch for them. They've been around in our community for years. They're a great company. Check them out. Check out their website. And then Matt wrote in to say he uses a site called Swappa, S-W-A-P-P-A, swappa.com. And again, I haven't used them, but he said, hey, I've bought some things from there, and that's worked out well for me as well. So there's some places you can check out if you're looking for discounted Mac products or just Mac and Apple accessories in general. I mean, PowerMax does sell new stuff as well. I don't know about the other two sites, but just some other places to check out. And thanks to everybody who sent in those recommendations. And then on the, you know, advantages of buying refurbished or not replacing your devices as frequently, Nick pinged me on Twitter, and I think he's ultimately going to send a audio comment to make his case. I hope he does. I suggested that he do that. But Nick pinged me to make the argument that really replacing your gear every 2 years or so can actually be more cost effective and better for you, and you might end up spending less money than if you upgrade less frequently. And the idea was that, you know, if you get your new gear within a couple of years, you can turn around and sell your old gear at a pretty good profit because Apple products maintain their resale value. So you might not actually be spending all that much to get the latest and greatest technology. And if you have newer, faster gear that's performing faster and it's better, you're going to be more efficient. Your stuff's going to run better. It's going to be less hassle. So you're going to save time. And, you know, the net result of those two things is you've got a pretty good money savings. And I kind of get that argument. But I think, Nick, you were kind of missing the bigger point, which again was me trying to point out, is that we don't have to put this pressure on people to always upgrade. And people don't always maybe have the money, and they shouldn't go into debt to try and finance a new computer purchase just because they want to have the latest and greatest thing, especially when the current product is working fine. And no matter whatever way you slice it, you're not going to be able to sell your old device and cover 100% of the cost of the new device. And I threw this back at Nick on Twitter, and then he pointed out, well, you know, if you get a lower cost device, you might be able to actually get newer technology, newer processors in a cheaper product, but then in a lot of cases you're downgrading. So, you know, for example, I have a 2011 15-inch MacBook Pro, and I like the MacBook Pro form factor, and when I replace it, I am going to replace it with a MacBook Pro. But to get a new MacBook Pro now, I'd be spending probably $2,500 to $3,000 to get the new machine that I want. And yes, I could turn around and maybe sell my 2011 15-inch MacBook Pro maybe for $1,000 if I was lucky. And you're right, if I had replaced it after about a year or two, I probably could have got more like $1,500, maybe even $1,800 for my existing one, which would drop the price of a new one about in half. But I'd still be spending about $1,000 to $1,500 to get that new machine. And that may or may not be money that I have available. That's still a lot of money for a lot of people. And especially considering that there's nothing wrong with my 2011 15-inch MacBook Pro. It doesn't run slow. I upgraded it with an SSD because that was about a $200 upgrade that I could afford. And the thing is great. I do everything on it. I record this podcast on it. I do all my programming on it. It works flawlessly. So I just don't see the need to replace something that isn't broken, that isn't running slow, that I'm not having problems with, and I don't have any complaints about it. It would just be spending money to spend money. And I'm saying, we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't be making people feel like they have to buy something that if they don't, well, you're using old technology and that sucks and that doesn't work. And I hear that a lot. You may think that's ridiculous, but I hear and I see people doing that to other people in our community. And it's just something I felt I needed to talk about and needs to stop. And then plus on top of all that, you know, keeping our products and our technology a little bit longer, an extra year or two, that does ultimately help out with the environment a little bit. It means that the equipment is sticking around a little bit longer. Yeah, in a lot of cases we hand ours down and it probably still will have a useful life, but every year longer that we can keep that device in use, it means it's keeping it out of the landfill, out of recycling, whatever it might be. And that's a good thing too. So there's a lot of good reasons for maybe holding on to our technology a little bit longer and not always chasing the upgrade cycle, which can get insane. It just can. And I'm just saying, let's stop doing that if we don't need to. If you need a new machine in 2 years, if you want a new machine in 2 years and you can afford it, more power to you. I'm not saying don't do that. Certainly not. If you want to do that, that is awesome. Do it. Buy one every year. Buy one every 6 months. I don't care. But I'm saying if you can't or you don't want to or you don't need to, don't feel pressured. Don't feel like you have to. So that was my point. If you'd like to chime in on this, and Nick, please, I really welcome. I'd love to hear your thoughts and your arguments on this in an audio form. Send me an audio comment. Shoot me an email. Give me some feedback. MacCast@gmail.com. If you own an Apple Watch, you may or may not know about a feature that is called auto responses. Specifically, you use these mostly for text messages. So if you get a text and you pull that up on your Apple Watch, there's a little reply button. And when you tap that, you're given some short canned responses right at the top that might be appropriate for that text message. So things like, hey, yeah, hello, or okay, I'm on my way. Yes, what's up? These sorts of responses. And you can simply tap those and it will automatically send that reply. They're these canned little things. And you can actually, a lot of people don't know this, customize those responses. If you open up the Apple Watch app on your iOS device and go under messages, you'll see a section called default replies. And if you go in there, you'll see all the standard replies, but you can override them. So if you're not the type of person who would normally respond hello, you might say something like, hey, then you can change hello to hey, and that will become the canned response that comes up for you. Well, it turns out these responses have another little trick that our friend and listener Gary stumbled onto, and I'll let him tell you about it.
I was talking to my friend on my Apple Watch. Well, I do use my Apple Watch to respond to people often, and I built a whole bunch of custom responses. And even though I really tried, most of them don't fit the criteria of what I, you know, want to say. You generally just say okay or no, which I think were already built in. But my friend messaged me, and there was nothing unusual about the message, but it just came back with everything in German, like nine, something else. You know, I took a semester or two in college of German, but don't remember that much. Wie heißt du? You know, so it had this series, and I'll send you a picture follow-up. But I thought, wouldn't that be cool if someone started talking to you in another language and you could respond back? But then again, if you don't know what the language is, it's not going to really mean much. So I wondered, it's probably just a fluke or a bug that caused it to happen. But I ended up responding back to my friend in German, and he knew German. So he's like, what? What do you mean? And I'm like, I don't really know what I mean. So I thought I'd pass that along, see if there's something more to it than a bug, if it can actually change languages like that.
Hey, Gary, you know, you piqued my interest with this, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about it. But I ended up testing this, and I got my wife to help me out, and I said, hey, send me something in Spanish. You know, send me a message in Spanish, and let me see what happens with my Apple Watch. And so, as you suspected, actually, I think this is a feature. What happened was, is that when it received the text message in Spanish, the canned replies on the watch, when I clicked the reply option, came up with Spanish options, at least at the top. So it looks like the Apple Watch is able to detect when another language is being used for a message, an iMessage or a text message, and then respond with, you know, give you language appropriate responses, which is kind of cool. And if you don't know what the responses are, you can actually scroll down on the Apple Watch and it'll offer up your native language responses kind of toward the bottom. But, you know, right there at the top, you get these language specific ones. And it looks like it worked for German. I would assume it would work for French and many other languages. Maybe if you have an Apple Watch and you know and speak a different language, maybe you can test this out and see if this works for you. But I thought that was really great. I mean, it actually is a feature and not a bug. Now, it'd be helpful if your native language on your iOS device is English, and it gives you those responses, if it could maybe put in parentheses or put on a second line or something like that what the English translation is, that would be a little bit more helpful. Because as you pointed out, Gary, sure, you could reply in that language, but you have no idea what you're replying, and it could be totally, you know, non-appropriate to the question that you were originally asked. But I guess if you're receiving the message in that language too, the assumption would be you must know how to read it in order to be able to reply to it. But anyway, I think it's a convenience thing, probably for people who are multilingual, which that obviously is not me. And it sounds like, Gary, maybe you know a little German, but sounds like you're a typical American native English-only speaker like myself. But cool feature nonetheless, and thanks for pointing that out. Terry wrote me this week, and he has an aging PVR, personal video recorder. He says it's dying, and he says, you know what, I'm really not all that interested in replacing it because I'm not doing a ton of live TV recording anymore, but I do it occasionally. But really, I'd rather get a new fourth generation Apple TV rather than spend $150 on a new personal video recorder. And the question, though, was, hey, if I do that, what kinds of solutions, or how can I get live TV recordings on or for my Apple TV without a lot of hassle? Because he says, you know, I'm doing that kind of thing now with my personal video recorder, but I've got to hook it up. I've got to transfer the files via USB. I've got to use MPEG stream clip to do some conversions, and then I got to use Handbrake to convert it to an iTunes compatible file and then put it into iTunes, and then I can use it on my iOS device or AirPlay it to an Apple TV or something like that. And that is a big pain. So is there a live recording solution that would maybe cost less, but more importantly, work better with a new fourth generation Apple TV? And I didn't know the answer to this question. So I, one, pinged our friend R. Derderian from the HDTV podcast to ask him, hey, how do we do this? And I also did a little bit of Googling and looked around. And luckily, Terry is using over-the-air channels. So he said, I don't have cable right now. I just use the over-the-air antenna, and I get that. And I found a product, again, it's not anything that I've heard of before or used, but it looks like it would do the trick, something called Simple TV. So I'm curious, if you have a Simple TV and you like it, send us your review. But basically, it's a little box. You attach your HD antenna to it. It's about $200 for the box itself, and then you can pay another $100 a year to get a premium service. Basically, it looks like what the premium service adds is the ability to remote access any content that is on the Simple TV device. So if you're not at home and you want to watch your recordings, or you want to watch live TV, you can get at it. But without that, just on your local network, if you just, you know, care about using it internally, you can go with this $200 box, plug in the antenna, hook it up to your network, and they have an Apple TV app that allows you to access and record live TV content from your Apple TV. Unfortunately, right now, it looks like they're currently sold out. So you may have to get on a waiting list, or it's back ordered, but that may be a possible solution. And that's just one box, kind of all in one. As I mentioned, I did ask Ara, and his solution was, he says, you know, I currently use a streaming TV box called the HD Home Run. And if you've ever listened to any of my sessions with Ara about setting up, you know, Mac Mini Home Theater or some of these other things, he's mentioned this product before. It lets you stream TV from the box to any devices or Macs or things that are on your home network. They don't currently have a digital video recorder version, so you can't record live TV with the box itself, but they're working on it. And I think they're actually taking some pre-orders where you can get in, pay a little bit of money up front, and I think you get a discounted price on the first batch of the DVR versions that are coming out. But basically, it's a box you plug in. They run between $129 to $149. It depends on whether you want one for an over-the-air antenna, or if you want one to plug into your cable service. If you're plugging into the cable service, it does look like you have to have a cable card. And I'm not sure how many cable companies still support that or do support that. But you can look at the two different options on there. That'll allow you to stream the TV, the TV to your Mac, And then for recording, what you can use and what Aura is using is iTV, EYETV, iTV3. It used to be an Elgato product. It's now, they've sold it to GeniaTech. I'll have a link in the show notes, but it's basically software that you run on your Mac, and it will let you record streams from the HD Home Run. So you can, you know, dial in the channel on HD Home Run and then record it to your Mac. The software costs about 80 euros, so you'll have to do the conversion for your own country. But that will let you record and get the metadata, and the Elgato software, or the ITV software rather, from what I remember, will automatically encode and dump that stuff into iTunes, and so you can throw it into the TV section and then use home sharing to be able to actually access that on your Apple TV. And then finally, for just accessing straight live TV on the Apple TV, there is an app called Channels at getchannels.com, and that will allow you to watch the live stream from the HD Home Run system and control the channels and things like that. So you can actually have live TV running across the network through that to your Apple TV. And that costs $24.99 for that software. So that's how Aura is doing it. Really the only disadvantage, I think, to the whole setup Aura has is you're going to be looking at, what, about $150, $130 to $150 for the HD Home Run box. Then you've got to spend about 80 euros on the software for recording, and then another 25. So you're going to be laying out a little bit of money up front, but then you'll have a solution that works pretty well and integrates with your Apple TV. And so there's a couple solutions for you, Terry. If you have a different solution or something else that you would recommend for this, shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. I will tell you, for me, you know, I don't watch a lot of first run TV shows. So the way I've gotten around this is I just buy a few seasons of my favorite shows directly on iTunes and then just get the digital versions directly. You don't even have to DVR those things. Apple's done it for you, basically, and you just get them. And then I sort of fill in with some of the channel apps, which a lot of them, like ABC, for example, will allow you to, for a week or two after the show airs, watch certain TV shows. So if your shows fall in those categories, you might be able to get by that way. And that's another little workaround for this. But send in your tips and recommendations, mattcast@gmail.com. And Terry, I hope that helps you out with a couple different options. Bob emailed me this week because he got a new iPhone SE. Congratulations, Bob. And mentioned that while he was transferring the data from his old iPhone to the new iPhone, he had a little bit of a scare because he accidentally lost all of his contact data, or at least he thought he did, because luckily it turned out just to be that it was slow syncing from iCloud. But in the time when he thought the contacts were all gone and iCloud hasn't synced up yet, he told me, hey, I was looking around, I went to my Time Machine backups, I went to my super duper backups, because he's a listener of the show, so he, you know, of course does good backups, but couldn't figure out how to recover the data files for contacts for the address book. And so it was a little bit scary, and he said, you know, I did ultimately, they all synced in from iCloud, so everything's okay, crisis avoided. But it got me thinking, you know, if the contacts had been totally gone, how would I have restored them from my backup? How do I do that? So can you walk us through that process? And Bob, I will be happy to do that. First things first, I would say before you, you know, do anything with your address book data, you may consider just making an archive backup really quick. And that's pretty easy to do. You just open up the contacts application, go under the contacts, go under the file menu rather, choose export, and you can export contacts as an archive. It basically just puts it into a address book file. And so you can save that off, you can put it wherever you want, put it on a backup drive. But that way you have a good clean copy of any existing contacts before you try doing anything. Now, of course, if it was the situation like you were describing where, boom, all your contacts were gone, well, now you've got to go to a backup, right? You've got to find the backup and you've got to restore them. As far as Time Machine goes, Time Machine is actually a Time Machine aware application. And what I mean by that is Time Machine actually works right inside the contacts app. So the way that you would have gotten your contacts back is you would have opened up contacts, it would have been totally blank, and then you would have activated Time Machine. And just like in the Finder, where, you know, it goes and shows you your Finder window going back in time, you know, several layers, what it would have done is shown you your contacts application window in several layers, and you could go back in time to the point where you had all your contacts and just restore all of them. Now, I will tell you, and I don't know if this is an existing bug, but when I tried this on my Mac, the contacts application crashed every time I tried to turn on Time Machine. So I don't know what was going on there, but if this happens to you, or Time Machine isn't working for some reason, then Plan B would have to go into effect. And that would be recovering the file directly from the Time Machine backup itself, or from a clone backup, you know, super duper carbon copy clone or whatever that might be. And the recommendation here would be make sure that you quit all applications that may be accessing your contact data. So it might not just be the contacts app, but think about things like calendar or mail, anything that might be tapping into that, just because you don't want any syncing or anything going on while you're trying to restore, you know, the actual raw data files. So quit all those applications. And then you need to go into your home folder's library folder. Now, if you haven't turned that on to be visible, the easiest way to get to that is hold down the Option key, and in the Finder, go under the Go menu and choose Library. And then once you're in the Library folder, you're going to open up the Application Support folder. And then inside that, you should see an Address Book folder. If it's not there, that may be your problem as to why, you know, the contact database is missing. But every time you open Contacts, it should recreate that folder. So it should be in there. But locate that. And then, so when you're in the Application Support folder, don't open up the Address Book folder, just stay right there and then activate Time Machine. And then you should be able to go back and find an earlier copy of the Address Book folder. You'll be able to select that and then choose Restore in Time Machine, and then that will bring that file forward. You, of course, could go, if you're using a clone backup, and just search for the Address Book folder in your clone backup and copy it over. Back over to your main hard drive. But either way, it should bring that back and put that back in the Application Support folder. So what you're looking to restore is that Address Book folder and all of the files and data that is inside of that. And if you're using the Time Machine method, you may be prompted if you want to, you know, replace the one that you currently have. You can choose to keep both if you'd like to, you know, keep a copy just in case something goes wrong and you want to try and roll back. But that should pretty much be it. That should be how you get your address book back. And this also got me thinking, or your contact data back. Address book is the old name for it, and contacts is new. So if that's confusing you a little bit, that's what's going on there. It's now called contacts, but still under the hood, it's still called address book, which I think even makes it even more tricky to find, which may be, Bob, why you were unable to find the actual data files, even when you went on your search. But this also got me thinking that it might not be such a bad idea to occasionally export your contacts, you know, as an archive file, as I described earlier. So, you know, occasionally go under the File menu, go to Export, and export the contacts archive, and just save that off once in a while. And that way you'll have a good local copy. If something does go south with iCloud or iCloud syncing or something like that, you can get back at your contacts data. You could even use a Calendar Automator workflow to have that happen automatically. And as a matter of fact, Chris Breen over at Macworld wrote up a great article on how to do exactly that. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. And then also, while I was doing the research for this, Frederico over at Mac Stories, he recommended an application called My Contacts Backup Pro that will actually create a backup of all of your contacts and either email it to you or put it into a Dropbox file. And you can do it as a CSV, or you can do it as vCards. It has a bunch of different options, and it can even send you reminders every week or every month to actually run the backup and do the backup. So that could be another little handy application for this. But Bob, I hope that I'm glad the crisis was averted with your contacts data, and hopefully now you'll be prepared. If something ever does happen to it, you'll be able to know where to go to look to recover this stuff. Okay, the last thing that I have for you today is my thing of the moment, and this should be a pretty quick one. It's actually an application that I had been considering buying for a while for my Apple TV and had just held off on, and I'm actually glad I did because it's actually on sale right now, and it's an app called Sketch Party TV. Sketchparty.tv is the website. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But you can pick it up for $5.99 US. The regular price is $9.99 US. And what it is it's a Pictionary-like game for your Apple TV. And you can use an iPad with AirPlay to play it, or they actually have a native Apple TV application that you can connect your iPads to remotely. And what's cool about it now, and the reason I picked it up now, is they just added support for the iPad Pro, and more importantly, the Apple Pencil. So it becomes really fun when you've got a big, you know, 12.9-inch iPad Pro and an Apple Pencil with support for, you know, thick and thin strokes through the tilt of the pencil, and it's Pictionary. So you can support up to 8 players per team, up to 16 people, 8 on 2 sides. I played with my family, and it was a ton of fun. So you're presented with a word, someone has to draw it, the other person is watching the Apple TV, and they have to try and guess what the person is drawing. A really simple game, not a lot to it, but just a ton of fun. Great party game, and a great way to integrate your technology, your Apple TV, and your iPad, and your Apple Pencil, right? It's just cool, right? Okay, I'm maybe a little bit nerdy, but I'm fully willing to accept that badge and wear it proudly. But a lot of fun, and like I said, it's half off right now. So Sketch Party TV, my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad. Along with PDF Pen Scan Plus, you can get more information and details. Check out all of their great software at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on the MacCast, you can send me email. My email address is maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. And you can check out our Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plus. MacCast, and that's the plus symbol. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.